Visiting teams get more than fresh towels and cereal bars in the visitors' clubhouse when they come to play the Indians at Cleveland's Progressive Field. These days, there's some distinctive artwork on the walls, portraits of players created in Legos by assistant clubhouse manager Wayne Peltz. He joins us now from WCPN in Cleveland. So who have you Legoed?
I started off with doing Jim Thome, and I've done Bob Feller.
Greatest Cleveland Indian pitcher of all time, can we say?
Correct. I mean, probably greatest Cleveland Indian of all time.
Yeah.
And I finished up a Mariano Rivera and a Dontrell Willis this week.
How did you get the idea to do this? I mean, were you the kind of kid when other kids were playing baseball, you were playing with Legos?
I was probably sitting home playing video games. I was a big nerd. I got the idea, though. I stole it from a baseball player, actually, from the Cleveland players. Jamie Carroll used to do all these amazing hand-drawn pictures. And I go, man, I want something one-of-a-kind like that, you know. So I started doing this.
Now, has, for example, Mariano Rivera seen his portrait?
No, he has not. He's going to be part of a one of four pieces. I'm going to do a piece with Pettit, Posada, Mariano, and Jeter all on it.
You're getting commissions to do some pieces, I hear.
Correct. The Dontrell Willis was commissioned by him. And the Carl Pavano and I are going back and forth on pictures and stuff, and he wants one, I think, with his son.
So how do you do this? They send you pictures and you put together the Legos?
Get a picture and I kind of draw it out like a five-year-old draw it out, just big circles and just kind of seeing how the shading and what colors I'd make what, and then I look back at it. Then I use the computer to help after I do that if I find a picture that would really work out well.
Mm. How long does it take you?
My pieces probably have around their... probably about 2,500 actual Legos in them. I like to say like 20 hours to even longer. I mean, it takes some time. I mean, even designing the first picture before I get started on it, it takes a couple hours at times.
Since we know you've gotten some commissions, can you give us some idea for what the going rate for a Lego portrait of a Major League Baseball star is these days?
I like to start off asking for around 500. Some guys are more generous than that as far as what they give you on top of that, if some of them do that.
500. Those guys in the Yankees clubhouse blow their nose into $500 bills. You know, some people would put together a few more portraits of famous Indians.
I mean, it's my boss's clubhouse, and I'm just kind of there living in his world. But what he gives me to put up two or so right now, I love it. I mean, it's awesome. Mm-hmm. You know, if he wanted the whole clubhouse done in Lego, I'd start working on it. I'd make Feller, Colavito, Satchel Paige. I can go down the line.
Those are the three great Indians. Throw in Herb Score, too, if you could, okay?
Will do.
Well, Mr. Peltz, thanks so much, and good Legos to you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Wayne Peltz, assistant clubhouse manager for the Cleveland Indians, and you can see some of his Lego artwork on our website. This is NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The U.S. economy has been growing for months, but many of the nation's unemployed won't feel that growth until they find work. Christina Romer is the White House chief economist.
I'm going to define a full recovery as the way the president does. Does everybody who wants a job have a job?
Based on yesterday's Labor Department report, that day still remains many years away. The government says the economy grew by more than 400,000 jobs in May, but nearly all of them were temporary ones for census workers. NPR's Frank Langfitt reports.
Millions of Americans remain unemployed. But the economy created just 41,000 private sector jobs last month. Investors responded by sending the Dow plunging more than 300 points. The White House's Christina Romer tried to put the best face on the disappointing job numbers.
The important thing is, of course, the longer run trajectory. What we're certainly focusing on is the fact that we've added private sector jobs for each of the last 5 months. If you actually go back, those add up to some 500,000 jobs since last December. So that's the big picture.
That is the big picture, but it's not enough. The recession destroyed more than 7 million jobs. Economists say replacing them and adding enough to account for population growth will take years. Mark Zandi is the co-founder of Economy.com.
We can't conclude that the economic coast is clear until we're creating enough jobs to bring unemployment down in a consistent and substantive way. And for that to occur, we need at least 150 to 200,000 jobs per month.
The unemployment rate did fall to 9.7% in May. But to bring it down a lot more, companies will have to become more confident in the recovery and start hiring in droves. So far, that just isn't happening. John Graham is a professor of finance at Duke. He surveys chief financial officers with CFO Magazine.
CFOs are saying right now that they would like to hire more because the demand for their product, in some sectors at least, is improving, but they're holding back until they realize this is long-term growth and not just kind of a little spurt of growth that might peter out in the second half of the year.
Our business has picked up tremendously in the last couple of months.
That's Jim Toohey. He's the chief financial officer at Direct Group. It's a big direct marketing firm based in New Jersey.
We're actually about 120% over where we were running early in 2009, 2008.
So in terms of demand, you've more than recovered from the recession?
We have.
But his payroll hasn't. Before the recession, the company employed 1,200 people. Now, his staff is about half that. And Toohey is cautious about bringing on full-time workers.
We're adding workers primarily through temp agencies.
That's because Toohey doesn't want to make a long-term commitment to new employees. He's not sure where the economy is headed, and he doesn't want to lay people off again.
I think that the uncertainties are many. You know, globally, there's just a lot of instability as far as economies, you know, the whole euro issue with Greece and Spain and Portugal. So I think there's just trepidation that something could happen that we may not even have control over.
Toohey is hopeful demand will continue. And if so, he could hire several hundred workers this summer. But, he says, they'll all be temps. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Washington.
Right in the middle of the Second World War, a top Nazi official named Gerhard von Mende managed to recruit thousands of captured Soviet soldiers for the German army. These soldiers were all Muslim, and all of them resented Soviet rule. Now, after the war, most of those soldiers remained in Germany and would eventually help the CIA penetrate the Iron Curtain. It was a project, argues author Ian Johnson, that allowed radical Islamists like the Muslim Brotherhood to establish a foothold in Europe. Ian Johnson's new book is called A Mosque in Munich. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
This mosque, as we'll hear, sort of became the center for the Muslim Brotherhood, certainly in Germany and to some extent in Europe. But before it became that, we have to sort of step back to the Second World War and Nazi Germany. How did the Nazi officials begin to think about using Muslims to work on their behalf?
Well, they began to realize that Muslims were potential allies in the war against the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union had oppressed Islam, closed many mosques, and mistreated many minorities in the Soviet Union, including Muslims. And after the Germans ended up with literally millions of Red Army POWs in the war, they began to realize that many of these were potential soldiers to fight the Soviet Union.
You talk about this guy, Gerhard von Mende, who really began this project during the Second World War. What happened to him after the war ended, and what happened to the project?
Well, after the war ended, left in Munich were roughly 1,000 to 1,200 Muslims who had managed, through various means, to escape deportation back to the Soviet Union. Von Mende, meanwhile, resurfaced in Düsseldorf as the head of a sort of freelance intelligence organization that was financed by several West German ministries. And he began to reassemble his team to work for West German aims in the Cold War.
How did the CIA then begin to get involved?
Well, the CIA got involved because the U.S. was also engaged in the struggle against communism, but on a much larger scale, of course. So they began to look around for where they could find some Muslims who could go into the Third World and counter Soviet propaganda and speak credibly. And they realized that here in Munich were a number of Muslims who could do that. The CIA set up a large covert propaganda operation in Munich and recruited many of these people.
Ian Johnson, we often hear about how U.S. covert support for radical Islamist groups really begins in Afghanistan, funding anti-Soviet Mujahideen fighters in the late 70s, early 80s. But you write that it really goes back to the beginning of the Cold War. There was a guy named Robert Dreher who was sent to Germany. He was a CIA operative. Tell me about him. What did he do?
Well, Dreher was an advocate of rollback. He didn't want to just contain communism. He wanted to roll back communism. So he shows up in Munich in the mid to late 1950s. There is this operation going on with some Muslims being sent out to the Third World, but he thinks it isn't enough. And he thinks that these people are probably not the most eloquent, the best educated people. So he begins looking around for other allies, and he sees the Muslim Brotherhood and decides to support their activities in Europe and elsewhere.
I mean, obviously, the United States and the Muslim Brotherhood shared this antipathy toward atheistic communists. But when did we start to see the seeds of this sort of U.S. West German project start to turn on the people who created it?
I think the main thing that happened was in the early 1960s, U.S. attention shifted elsewhere, primarily to Southeast Asia, with the Vietnam War heating up. My impression is that they were no longer focusing too much on this, and it stayed like that for about the next 15 or 16 years until the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in the late 1970s.
How was the Munich Mosque tied to the attacks of September 11, 2001?
There's no direct ties. However, a couple of people who were closely linked to several attacks were active at the mosque. For example, in 1998, one of the Al-Qaeda financiers was arrested while visiting people who frequented the mosque, and he was extradited to the United States.
You write that both the Bush administration and the Obama administration supported some efforts to work with and cultivate Islamist groups. How so?
Shortly after 9/11, there was this desire to cut all ties with Islamist groups like the Muslim Brotherhood and even to prosecute them. The fundamental problem with that effort was that it tried to link them directly to terrorism, which is really not so much what the Muslim Brotherhood does. The Muslim Brotherhood creates the worldview that can lead to terrorism, the milieu where that can flourish. So after these prosecutions failed, the Muslim Brotherhood reestablished itself, and by the second term of the Bush administration, there were already very clear efforts where Brotherhood groups in Europe are being clearly cultivated for U.S. foreign policy aims. So much of the rhetoric that you hear today is similar to what we were saying in the 1950s, that Islam is essentially a tool that we can use for foreign policy purposes. I think this is this is a fundamental problem in how we look at this religion. It's come back to haunt us again and again, but we continue to make the same mistake.
That's former Wall Street Journal reporter Ian Johnson. His new book is called A Mosque in Munich, Nazis, the CIA, and the Rise of the Muslim Brotherhood in the West. Ian Johnson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For more on the situation in Gaza and a look back at the rest of the week's news, we're joined now by NPR senior news analyst Dan Shore. Morning, Dan.
Good morning, Scott. And what a world we inhabit on this balmy Saturday morning, where we have an oil blockade of our southern shores and a hate blockade of Mediterranean shores.
You were able to listen to the report from Gaza. Do you think Israel is more or less likely to lift the blockade or change its policy?
I would not predict what Israel will do. They'll be very reluctant to do it. They assert their rights to conduct this blockade and to stop ships, even though they're in international waters. I think I don't want to be involved in having to judge that one.
The Obama administration has so far expressed only regret for the loss of life in the attack earlier this week on that ship that was bound for Gaza. Do you see this incident as leading the president to sharpen or downplay some of the differences he's had with the Israeli government?
Yes, but apparently he'll do it most reluctantly. I mean, he has never really yet taken a position against Israel. And so he expresses great regret over lives lost. He hopes for the best and so on. He is stuck there in the middle in a position where he clearly does not like this blockade. On the other hand, doesn't like taking a position against Israel.
And let's move to the oil spill. It's now been 6 weeks since it began in the Gulf of Mexico. More globs of oil washing on the beaches in the Gulf, and presumably there will be a lot more. More animals have already been caught up in the spill and harmed. How do you, at this point, begin to fix responsibility for both the spill and the cleanup, or the lack of cleanup?
Well, it seems rather clear, judging from what has come out since that time, it seems rather clear that this thing could have been avoided, that there were warnings given by people involved in it saying, hey, this isn't working right and that's not working right. The fact is they took profits over the possibilities of trouble, and that was where we ended up.
What do you make of pundits, analysts, and some politicians, including, I suppose, notably James Carville, who say that President Obama, elected as an inspirational figure, hasn't evinced the kind of emotion, both sympathy and or anger, that could motivate and inspire people to do something in an unfolding crisis?
Well, everybody plays his role, and James Carville plays his role, and I guess we'll see this going on. The fact of the matter is the president, who just finished his third trip there in the past couple of weeks, and talks to people and talks to business people and does everything he possibly can, has certainly tried to show that he will do everything he possibly can to support, including now in his radio address this morning, yet once again, we will stand by you. I am personally not sure what more our president can do than he is already doing.
According to the polls and what you see, are there Americans who, on the one hand, blame BP for the spill, yet also blame the federal government and the president for not doing more over the past 6 weeks to stop the oil from reaching shore?
Well, it's like blaming the financial companies down on Wall Street. They're there. They are meant to be attacked when it's necessary to attack somebody. And yes, I mean, BP has a great burden to bear, and they will be made to bear it.
For the second time, the president has canceled a trip to Indonesia and Australia. The president of the United States is perhaps beyond argument the busiest man in the world. But in times of some dominant crisis, as this spill has become over the past few weeks, do efforts and other important things, including foreign policy, get distracted?
Obviously, something has to give. And the president has now, for a second time, the first time he postponed that visit to Indonesia and to Australia was because he was very busy trying to get his health bill passed. Now he has another reason. The fact of the matter is, when the president is totally preoccupied with a great crisis here at home, it is very difficult to keep up with some of the things around the world which he should be keeping up with.
Another dimension entirely. The Washington Post reported this week that the Obama administration has significantly expanded its use of special operations forces. These are covert teams operating in as many as 73 countries around the world.
Yes.
Including targeted killings, civilian casualties. Quote from a government source said, quote, "This administration has authorized things that the last one didn't." What do you make of this expansion of policy and the relative lack of attention?
Well, Scott, almost every president likes to have more direct action than he normally gets from the Pentagon. And so he assembles his own little force in order to go hunt terrorists. It's been done before, and I think it will probably be done again.
But didn't this administration come to power after criticizing and continuing to criticize the last one for conducting these kinds of operations?
But it's different when you're in the White House and you've collected a lot of enemies around the world and you'd like to take more direct action against them.
Let me get you now to turn your view to the economy, Dan, because new numbers are out this week. Private employment in May was up by 41,000 jobs. Payrolls were up. Unemployment dipped a bit. How do you analyze these numbers?
Yeah, well, the sad truth is that 95% of the new jobs were jobs temporary for the census given by the Census Bureau, and apparently simply do not mean very much. The fact of the matter is that the jobs are not coming back as fast as everybody hoped, and it may well be that there might be a little touch of a second recession.
Dan, the trial of former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich began in Chicago this week. They're still in jury selection. What do you foresee over the next 3 months?
Well, what I foresee over the next few months is that this trial will go on and people will turn to it almost for relief from some of the big stories around the world.
Thanks. Well, I'll certainly be watching. NPR Senior News Analyst Dan Shore, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Oil from BP's blown-out well is spreading further through the Gulf of Mexico. It's now washing up on some beaches in Florida. Southerly winds are also pushing greater concentrations of brown sludge onto the Louisiana coastline. NPR's John Idstey visited one of the hardest-hit beaches near Grand Isle.
Grand Isle is at the very end of Louisiana Highway 1. It's surrounded by water. This is where the state's vast marshland meets the Gulf of Mexico. The town's marina is a launch point for boats carrying cleanup crews onto remote beaches. But this boat is carrying a small group of journalists. Ivar Van Heerden, a famous defender of Louisiana's fragile coastline, is taking them out for a look at the damage.
Okay, so don't be alarmed. The boat is going to vibrate some. There's a lot of Katrina trash, as we call it, in the water. And they hit some this morning with this boat, so it's got a bent propeller.
Van Heerden is something of a hero among environmentalists for his tenacious efforts to protect the Louisiana coast. His strong views recently got him fired from his professor's job at LSU. Now he's working on the spill cleanup as a member of a shoreline cleanup assessment team for a BP contractor. The teams investigate areas of reported spills and prescribe the proper cleanup. Today, he's headed for a beach on Grande Terre Island.
Any accident, the guy's where I can tie you up here. This looks like the best place right here, anyhow. Yeah.
There are just a few weather-worn houses on stilts on one side of Grande Terre. They're all that remains of an old state fish and wildlife camp. But the oil is on the other side, the Gulf side, on a long, narrow sand beach.
This is new oil. It was reported this morning by our air crews. It came ashore with the high tide late yesterday. And what we've seen is a mixture of tar balls and paddies, as we call them. It looks about 40% cover. This would be some of the heaviest oiling that I've certainly seen in the last month.
Is that alarming to you?
No, because this can be cleaned up.
And just up the beach, there's a crew dressed in white and yellow hazard suits doing just that. 27-year-old Ian Guidry, a former offshore oil worker, is the team leader.
The consistency is like peanut butter, almost. It's real thick. Right now, in these areas, we got about, I guess it's somewhere around 6 to 8 inches in some spots.
But the oil is less than an inch thick on the several hundred yards of beach visible from where we're standing.
This particular island's about 5.5 miles long, and it's like that from coast to coast.
Guidry is down on one knee, wiping the oil off the sand with what looks like a thick paper towel. Other team members are using shovels and rakes. It all goes in large white garbage bags. Guidry says his crew of about 25 are filling around 50 bags an hour, but the wind and waves keep pushing more oil ashore.
We'll get about 90% of this cleaned up before the sun goes down, and when we come back at 6 o'clock in the morning, it'll look like we didn't do anything.
Despite what he's seen today, Ivar Van Heerden says so far damage from oil coming ashore has been overstated. That's a bit surprising coming from a staunch environmentalist. But he says in the marshlands, the thick grasses are acting a bit like a protection boom. They keep the oil from penetrating more than a couple of meters. He says the oil dries quickly and flakes off the stems, apparently not doing the grass any real harm.
We've been incredibly lucky, and I say that as a Louisianan. We've had, over 5,000 miles of shoreline, and it's only tens of miles that have been oiled, and very, very few areas that have been heavily oiled.
What's scary, says Van Heerden, is the massive amount of oil offshore. And if a hurricane strikes, its surge could push oil over the protective barrier of grasses and deep into the marshland, causing great damage.
You know, in Louisiana, we're hoping and praying that we do it every year, that we don't have any hurricanes, and we're adding an extra couple of little prayers this year about no hurricanes.
Unfortunately, forecasters are predicting one of the worst hurricane seasons ever for the Gulf this year. John Idsty, NPR News, Southern Louisiana.
I don't care who wins this year's World Series. Doubt it'll be the Cubs in any case. I think the enduring highlight of the 2010 season occurred Wednesday night when an umpire named Jim Joyce blew a call that would have given Armando Galarraga of the Detroit Tigers that rarest of achievements, a perfect game, 27 batters up, 27 down. Last out should have been a ground ball to first base on which Mr. Galarraga took the throw well ahead of the runner, but Jim Joyce called the runner safe. The contrary evidence on video was immediate and glaring. Yet, Armando Galarraga didn't fume or spew. Didn't call his lawyer or the players' union. He smiled and went back to work, getting one last out to win a one-hit shutout over the Cleveland Indians while losing what may be his lifetime chance for a perfect game. Jim Joyce looked at video at the play and tearfully told reporters, "I just missed the damn call. I took a perfect game away from that kid over there who worked his butt, and he didn't say butt, off all night." Then he went into the Tigers' locker room to apologize to Armando Galarraga, and Mr. Galarraga told reporters, "Nobody's perfect. I understand. I feel for the guy." Voices from the Nation to National Review have called on the commissioner of Major League Baseball to intervene and reward Armando Galarraga a perfect game. Doesn't look like he'll do that. He may consider expanding video reviews in baseball. I'm among those fans who've opposed using video replays that would slow down the game and make it too serious by analyzing every pitch like it was the BP oil spill. I now think that view is as antiquated as a Sony Walkman. These days, managers and coaches watch replays on laptops in the clubhouse, studying a pitcher's motion or a batter's hitch as intently as CIA analysts looking for Al-Qaeda hideouts in the mountains of Pakistan. A good umpire's rare mistakes already get replayed over and over on stadium scoreboards, TV, and the web, like video of a stick-up on America's Most Wanted. So I've come to think that permitting a team to ask for, say, 2 video replays a game would ensure that they were used sparingly and might save a fine man and umpire like Jim Joyce the humiliation of a wrong call. Armando Galarraga's great performance won't go into the record books as a perfect game, but the real human grace that both he and Jim Joyce displayed this week, a pitcher and umpire, as natural adversaries as cats and dogs, became a portrait of inspiration that's bigger than the fine print in any record book. You know what? I think it was a perfect game. And you're listening to NPR News.